As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. No one has been more articulate about value than Grantham, Mayo, and Van Otterloo. Ben Inker joins us this morning in support of Jeremy Grantham and the need to consider value among raging tech growth. Ben, thank you for joining us. You've got a quarterly letter out. I love the detail you go into. There's no consultants here telling you what to do. What is the number one message that we get wrong as we put in the next buy ticket for Apple and Amazon?
The number one thing that I think people get wrong is if you buy a market, if you buy a company, if you buy a situation where things are about as good as they have ever been, you're probably not going to get a great return going forward. You get the best returns when you are buying at not the best times. This has been a wonderful time for big tech. This has been a wonderful time for the S&P. You really want to be looking for the places where this hasn't been quite as wonderful.
Where are they? Where is the mean reversion going constructively back to the mean?
So what we see is value stocks generally, and I think you want to be smart about how you're defining value stocks, but honestly, any way you define value stocks, they look really cheap relative to history. And what we think is if you're looking intelligently at the valuations of the stocks that have been left behind, they're trading at some of the biggest discounts to the market we have ever seen. And there doesn't seem to be a really good economic reason for it. So sooner or later, you're going to get a really good return out of it.
Ben, there's a reason why some of the big tech stocks have done so well, and it comes from the cash that they are generated. It comes from the fact that they are somewhat independent of some of the price pressures because they don't have as many employees relative to their overall cash flow. It also comes from the fact that they are on the vanguard of a shift, a technological shift in the community that was frankly accelerated during the pandemic. How do you sort of counteract all of those forces and say, look, that's all baked in. These other stocks are going to benefit as we revert to a normal economy?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One is there's a lot of craziness going on in the economy. We do see some stocks trading at utterly loony valuations. Big tech is not the core of that, right? You can say, hey, Google's been on a great run. You can say Apple's been on a great run. They don't look cheap, but they don't look stupid. There's plenty of stuff in the market that does look pretty stupid.
Like what?
And the Teslas, the AMCs, the meme stocks are trading at valuations where you have to assume utterly extraordinary things to get a decent return. A quarter of the market right now is trading at more than 10 times sales, which is utterly crazy. Stocks trading at 10 times sales or more historically have underperformed the market profoundly. And today, a quarter of the market is trading at that huge multiple.
But Ben, some people would argue if you try to go to, say, the Russell 2000 as a value proposition because they tend to be less loved, you end up buying a lot of AMC, a lot of GameStop, which suddenly account for a bigger proportion of these indexes. How do you get around that?
Well, I think buying the indices right now is a tough thing, right? Because whenever you're buying the indices, you are buying those stocks which have very high market caps. In the case of, Apple and Amazon and stuff, they are legitimately huge companies. For some of these companies, AMC is a wonderful example. the company isn't huge, just the market cap has exploded. And I think you want to be careful doing anything that assumes that that market cap is correct, right? The Russell has had a heck of a run since the lows of last year. It is not cheap either. I'm not making the argument that the S&P is expensive, buy the Russell too. I'm saying growth has been on a great run. Growth is expensive, buy value.
Benninger, value is founded on certain Bibles. One of them is Graham Dodd and Caudle. You and I read it cover to cover ages ago. You guys have led the charge on growth. The growthiness that we've got now is unusual. All of that is based on Fed and central banks blowing out their balance sheets. How do you perceive markets reacting when they finally have to pull in their balance sheets or at least stabilize them?
You know, I really wish I knew. You know, it's not just that what the Fed has done in the aftermath of COVID has been unprecedented. Even insofar as we have precedents, we saw what happened in the GFC. Man, it's really hard to truly disentangle the impact of quantitative easing from the impact of very low interest rates. I mean, yes, we had a taper tantrum, but it was a pretty short-term phenomenon. The Fed has this belief that balance sheet expansion is the equivalent of a further drop in interest rates. That belief is not really backed by strong empirical evidence. I don't know what impact the Fed balance sheet and the expansion of the Fed balance sheet has had. It seems like it would be the kind of thing that would push people more into risky assets. But when we've tried to crunch the data, we don't see an obvious smoking gun for here's how that impacted the market before. Here's how undoing it is going to impact the market now.
Ben? Valuable insight this morning. We appreciate it. Benninger there of GMO, the head of asset allocation.
Right now, to continue our discussion of now what for Central Asia, Robert Hormats joins us. He's the Tiedemann Advisors that barely describes a cross-party public service to this nation. Yes, working with Secretary Clinton, but long ago and far away working for others and driving the 148 miles from Kabul to the Khyber Pass. Bob Hormats, you're one of the few people with real boots on the ground experience over there. How does the United States now manage the Western Pakistan tribal regions? How does the United States manage a new relationship with Pakistan?
Well, it's going to be a challenge because we've seen the Taliban as our enemy for so long, and now we find that we're working with them to help get people out of the country. And I suspect that over a period of time, we're going to have something of a dialogue with the Taliban. The other point is that the bigger threat to the United States is really ISIS or ISIS-K, and the Taliban is their arch enemy. So it may turn out that if ISIS-K starts threatening its neighbors or us over the right. longer run, we're going to have to work with the Taliban to try to right. suppress them. In fact, in the earlier agreement, they said that they would not allow terrorists to operate from their territory.
And Bob, I want you to take a broader picture here, which only you can do with, you know, you darkened the door at Tufts a few years ago. You can do this. I want you to take us back to John Kenneth Galbraith as ambassador to India, and we had to manage India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. What do we do now? We don't have Robert Hormats. We don't have JKG. What do we do now to manage that strange relationship?
Well, it is going to be difficult. The Indians themselves now, who have regarded Pakistan, of course, as a threat, are worried about several things. They're worried about the fact that there may be jihadist elements based in Afghanistan who move over into Pakistan or the disputed territories or Kashmir and pose threats to India. So what India is now doing already, we've just learned, is they've been having secret meetings with Taliban authorities to try to make sure
right.
that the Taliban can control these forces.
Okay.
in the country and elsewhere.
Bob, you know, we talked to John Bolton about this yesterday. Bob, you're the expert at this. Should Blinken be on the next plane to Delhi?
Well, I do think we need to have a lot of cooperation with Delhi. And I would certainly, if I were Tony Blinken, be working with the Indians on how we deal with the Taliban and how we control ISIS and ISIS groups that are in Pakistan that could cause lots of disruptions, both in India and the areas around it, and certainly could play a disruptive role in Kashmir. The other interesting thing is that we may have a lot of interests in common with the Chinese and the Russians. They are concerned about ISIS and ISIS-K, and they want to be able to work with, and China, of course, has a border with Afghanistan, so they want to work with the Afghanis to try to control these movements that could base themselves in Afghanistan, but could be disruptive to the region itself.
Bob, taking a step back, there is a concern that President Biden talks in a much nicer tone toward the allies, toward Europe in particular, but doesn't necessarily act that differently than the Trump administration when it comes to policies and the way that things are carried out. And that's one thing that people have argued has just been perpetuated with the Afghanistani exit. How much do you think that they are actually changing the dynamic post-Trump versus is just continuing it?
Well, this particular incident is going to have an impact because the allies were concerned. They weren't consulted in advance. And now, of course, the Germans are having elections and refugees from Afghanistan are going to be one issue. Do the Germans take them? How much do they trust the United States? I think we're going to see, in part as a result of this, a much closer set of ties and consultations between the United States and many of our allies and many countries that are not allies about how to deal with the Taliban and particularly how to deal with this refugee issue. This is going to be a very big issue in American politics. And we have just begun to recognize this. They're now in temporary quarters, but we've got to find long-term homes for a lot of these people. And we're going to have to work with the allies to do it. So I think the lack of real pre-consultations in the eyes of some of these countries is going to mean we're going to have to spend a lot more time working with the allies on a multitude of post-takeover Taliban issues.
Ambassador Hormats, thank you so much for joining us today with Tiedemann Advisors.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
It is not to be understood that we invented this out of thin air. Long ago, Paul, and far away, there was a plan. And off the back of an envelope, the plan, I had a beverage of my choice in my left hand.
Of course.
Was, well, wait a minute. Richard Edelman says this, and I can't convey to all listening nationwide and around the world the importance of the Edelman Trust Barometer in launching me. It's breathtaking. Richard Edelman joins us 400 years on through a pandemic to tell us about the trust barometer of our institutions. As always, Richard Edelman, thank you so much for joining.
Good morning, Tom.
What have you learned in the pandemic?
Tom, the most important finding of this study is the rise of belief-driven employees. And the employee is no longer willing just to work for pay and advancement. He or she wants flexible work hours and also wants to work for a company that is dedicated to improving society. And the amazing thing, Tom, is somewhere between, depending on the country, 20 and 40% of employees say that they're going to quit in the next 6 months. They've gotten through the pandemic and they want something new. By 2-1, the reason for quitting is societal ambition of their employer. They don't agree with the values of the company. 60% said that. Only 30% say that it's because of cash compensation or advancement.
Oh, come on. You're not telling. I mean, I get what you're saying, Richard.
This is a tough sell,
Richard. The bottom line is they want to be paid more and find a social belief in their CEO. You're telling me no?
I'm telling you that table stakes is the wages and upside in their career. And the additional aspects of flexibility on hybrid work or, you know, for example, a staggered shift for a manufacturing company so that you don't have to be there at 7 a.m. on the GM line. You could be there at 8 if you're a mom or a dad dropping a kid at school, but then you still could work the 8 hours. We're going to have to figure this out. There's a new social contract that we're going to have to create, and it can't just be for the white-collar worker.
And
you know, that's the unfairness of it all.
What's so important, Paul, I got to paint the picture for you. I'm at Davos, and Lionel Barber would have his Wednesday opening FT Edelman Trust Barometer soiree, and they would invite me. And, you know, it'd be Richard Edelman and mimosas and, you know, Julie Andrews singing in the background. Richard, you've done this year after year. Is this about corporations and the new belief, or is it about the failure of government as an institution?
As always, Tom, it's a little of both. Government has disappointed us. I mean, the most recent is, what are we supposed to be doing about vaccinations? As employers, we're left on our own. You know, do we mandate them? Do we say you have to have a vaccine before you come to the office? Do we wear masks? I mean, all of this is a bit in limbo. So business is stepping into the void left by government. And that's increasingly true on pay, on benefits, on even vaccination. So it is true, though, interestingly, that if a employer has high trust from its employees, it drags up all the institutions and trusts. It's one of the shockers in this study is, you know, if you have a 9 or above on a 10 scale level of trust in your employer, all the other institutions from media to business get much higher scores. And if it's only a level 5, then we're in trouble because
Richard,
then collapse of trust in institutions.
Richard, I wonder how much of this is a function of the fact that pre-pandemic we were at full employment. Now, coming out of the pandemic, despite the Delta variant, you know, there's a lots of employers that need lots of employees, so there's some leverage for the employee. How much it is that, or how much is it, again, like as you're suggesting, a real fundamental change in the construct between employer and employee?
I think in the back of every employee's head is still, I'm afraid of being fired on the basis of artificial intelligence or other tech.
Right.
80% of people say that still today. And so they're thinking, look, also, I've just seen my mom die. 50% of Americans actually had a person they knew pass away or be sick from COVID. That's a big shock to the system. So, you know, we're having traumatic stress syndrome a little bit, and we're reevaluating who we are and what we want to be. And that's why I think it's a tripod now. It's pay and upside. It's flexible work conditions, and I want to work for an employer I want to succeed. You know, it's really important to have all three.
Yeah. Richard Edelman, thank you so much for your support of our effort over the years. And folks, I can't say enough about the Edelman Trust Barometer and the other social studies that Edelman and Company do. Richard Edelman, the founder of Edelman and Company.
Let's catch up with Roger Bootle, shall we? Capital Economics founder and chairman and the author of a book, The Death of Inflation. That was the mid-90s. Roger joins us now in 2021. Roger, if you wrote that book today, what would the title be?
I'm not sure. I think I might be tempted to call it The Rebirth of Inflation. I probably adopted a completely different title. The title, you know, at the time, 96 I published it, caused fantastic argument. The Bundesbank in particular were very angry with me. Inflation, they said, can't possibly die. I'm worried about inflation resurging now.
Roger Bootle, we had Jeff Lacker on the other day, the former president of the Richmond Fed, and he was extremely articulate about a need for preemptive central banks. And I asked him where the inflationistas got it wrong. And at the same time, I talked to Geeta Gopinath off Jackson Hole about modern monetary theory. In the last 10 years, have we simply moved our inflation dynamic, our price dynamic, over to a balance sheet dynamic, whether it's fiscal policy or it's all this debt buildup we see out there?
I don't think either of those things, really. I think what's happened is a combination of two things. First of all, we've continued to have various supply factors which have been bearing down on inflation, and those are the things that I identified in the middle 90s. They've been continuing. And then, of course, for a variety of reasons, we've had a relatively weak demand. And in key countries like the US, I think those two conditions are now changing. I mean, the US economy is surging. You've got this massive stimulus from policy at a time when I don't think there's quite the same downward pressure on prices from various supply factors, and in many cases, of course, there's upward pressure on prices. As for MMT, I think it's just, quite frankly, profoundly misguided.
Roger, can we get sustained increases in inflation without more wage inflation? And based on where we are, wage inflation that we're not seeing?
Well, you can in some circumstances. I mean, I think they're pretty unlikely. I mean, you've got to have either a very, very marked shift towards profits or big increases in external costs, which are pushing inflation for a considerable time. In the end, of course, that will come to an end. No, I think, you know, really to continue with high inflation for quite a while, we're going to need wage inflation. At the moment, there are some signs of that. It depends where you look. But right. In some countries, wages are going up quite a lot. But, you know, the whole thing about inflationary process, this is what makes it so difficult to forecast and to set policy, is the answers aren't always obvious to you. They aren't given you on a plate. You don't suddenly see the whole process unfold immediately. It happens over time, gradually.
Roger, one final question, very important here. You could literally be lined up right now working at the Bank of England, helping Governor Bailey. Do you presume smooth curves and smooth reaction functions when we're finally over with the stimulus party, or do you have an angst out there about jump conditions we don't see coming?
Well, I'm worried about a jump, and this is one of the reasons why I would act on policy sooner rather than later, in both the States, actually, and the UK. These current levels of interest rates are absurdly low. The monetary stimulus is extraordinary in the course of history. We've got to move back to some sort of normality, and I would do it sooner rather than later and do it gradually in order to avoid the thing you're referring to, Tom. That's to say that at some point or other, we get a shock and the policymakers overreact.
Roger, thank you, sir. It's good to hear from you, as always. Roger Bootle there, Capital Economics founder and chairman of perhaps the rebirth of inflation.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Right now, I want to rationalize to the year end, and we do that with James Athey of Standard Charter. Thrilled that he could join us. Standard Investments, Aberdeen Standard Investments, I should say. James Athey, thank you so much for joining us. James, it's September 1. Guys like you have to re-rationalize till 12/31/21. How much rationalization is going on right now? How much of institutional money is behind the benchmark?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, the fourth quarter brings with it its own special set of dynamics. Normally, summer has tended to be a quiet period, and certainly in terms of primary market activity, it's generally pretty dead. And then as we get towards the end of August, we look into the fourth quarter and think, well, there's still a heck of a lot of companies and governments out there with funding needs. They're going to come to market. So you get this kind of concession event into the fourth quarter supply. This year, it's a bit more complicated because we've got the potential for some relatively major monetary policy changes as well. both of those have the potential to drive bond yields higher. But you know, as you guys were talking about in your previous section there, thinking about bond yields in isolation doesn't get you very far. You have to think about what's going to happen to bond yields, what's going to happen to the yield curve, what's going to happen to the dollar, and what does that mean for risk assets? And that's where it gets a bit more complicated. John, I'm still of the opinion that fourth quarter is going to be about a flatter yield curve in the U.S.
Yeah, John, Standard & Poor's 500, 12 months trailing, up 28%. Year to date, John, it's terrible. It's up 20%.
It's not bad, is it, Tom?
How many people are behind?
A lot of people. And James, I think the big question right now is what dense risk appetite. We know that the equity market can go higher in a rising rate regime over at the Federal Reserve. We know that the equity market can rally even as they pull back on QE. What will hit risk appetite?
Yeah, I mean, we know all of these things until we don't. I try really hard to avoid foiling into sort of some of the basic cognitive bias traps, and the status quo bias, I think, is one of the strongest. We have a tendency to believe that what is true today will continue to be true tomorrow. By the same token, I can sit here in front of you guys week after week saying I think the equity market is fragile, and I'll end up with egg on my face more often than not. But I think the kind of equity market that we live in now is one where, you know, you get such long periods of this grinding low volatility rally, but when it does crack, it, you get all of the volatility in one go. And I still think we're headed for that sort of episode. But what the phrase we use is vulnerabilities, not triggers. Ex ante, it's almost always impossible to point out a specific event or data point or you know, happening which is going to be the trigger for things to turn around. But what you can do is you can look at the market and say, well, how vulnerable is this market? How expensive is it? How much are investors already positioned? What is investor sentiment like? And when you look at the equity market, how many people are buying on margin? What sort of investors are participating? What's breadth like? You know, what's the median stock doing relative to the index itself? And when you look at beneath the hood in all of these metrics, I just see weakness and vulnerability and unsustainable drivers. So I have no idea when the equity market will crack, but I strongly believe that the fundamentals which are supposedly supporting equity prices up here are not anywhere near as supportive as many are making out.
James, getting an idea for what you don't want to own. What do you want to own?
Really difficult. People ask me that question, you know, outside of the industry and say, what should I do with my money? And give a big sigh and say it's very difficult. Everything is expensive. Not even just financial assets, alternative assets across the board. Some of the crazes going on in alternative you know, places to park one's money, I find terrifying in the extreme. But for most investors, you're still owning a diversified portfolio of you know, the basic financial asset types is very sensible. What do I particularly want to own in my space? I still think the duration, it has value because, yes, it's expensive, but it's not as expensive relative to the economic outlook as most other assets are. I think that's the biggest
thing that I would say. James, are you buying 30-year bonds right now? Are you buying, you know, the longest dated notes in developed markets? Is that basically the way that you're getting some confidence?
In the US, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly where we're positioned. So we like 5s, 30s, flatness. We like owning the long end because ultimately, the long end should be the clearest and cleanest expression of, you know, the potential output of the US economy. And my observation, and this goes back to, again, a conversation you guys were having before about the labor market. My observation is that when policy in its various guises steps away from the US, from any major economy, the economy literally has a heart attack. So without temporary inputs from policymakers, the state, the current state of the economy is unsustainable. Therefore, we will tend to negative growth until we find some equilibrium. And the policy that we're engaging in is completely unsustainable. And that tells me that we're still living in this unhealthy, imbalanced, over-indebted economy with lots of structural weaknesses, which people are trying to deal with cyclical policy. And that really does cap the extent to which yields can rise before it causes some sort of incident or accident. And I think we've seen a little, you know, a little episode of that already this year. But I continue to believe that that long-term duration has better value than alternatives.
James Athey of Aberdeen Standard Investments, Senior Investment Manager.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations, and subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.